The Tom Woods Show, episode 1705.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, I don't know about you, but I am running into a lot of progressives saying, look, police, fire, schools, these are all great examples of socialism. Well, let's focus on that school example. I've got a free ebook called Education Without the State that makes a pretty darn good case for a stateless approach to education. Pick it up at nostateeducation.com. Hey, everybody, Tom Woods here. I took a day off yesterday because Saturday, August 1st, was my birthday. So I made that into a long weekend of relaxation. But here we are back with the Tom Woods Show. And I want to say before we start today, I made a mistake in my episode, 1703. I was telling you about the three courses I made for the Ron Paul curriculum, and I was telling you how you could get them. And I said, well, you can get them by joining the Ron Paul curriculum at ronpaulhomeschool.com. You can get them a la carte, just these courses. If you don't want to join the whole curriculum, you can get them at tomwoodshomeschool.com. And you can get them as a gold or above member of the Supporting Listeners program at supportinglisteners.com. But I forgot to mention that they are also a bonus you receive when you are a master member of my Liberty Classroom website. So libertyclassroom.com, become a master member, and you get those courses as part of that membership. And I always have coupon codes for you good listeners at libertyclassroom.com/coupon. So just clearing that up, that's now taken care of. All right, talking today to Zach Weissmuller, who has been creating documentary videos for a long time, about 10 years, over at reason.com and Reason TV. And he's got a video that I want to talk about today and expand on, talking about the Trump foreign policy and what the promise of it was and how it's turned out and what we should think about it. And that video interviews two people who will be familiar to Tom Woods Show listeners, Thad Russell and the great Scott Horton. So a good video. I'll link to it on the show notes page. And we're going to talk about this important topic. Zach, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me. It's a real privilege to be here. I've been a fan of your work for a long time. I read Meltdown back when I was kind of just getting out of college and all the financial craziness was happening. And it gave me this insight into, I was just dipping my toe into the world of Austrian economics. And it gave me just a real tangible world example of how that all works, the boom-bust cycle. And also, you know, looking at the way that an entire, a huge story can just be missing, and the conventional wisdom can just be missing an entire aspect of the story. And that was kind of one of the first eye-opening moments there, reading that book. So it's a privilege to be here talking to you.
Oh, I appreciate that very much. So I can tell you're a youngster from the way you just dated yourself as to when you read the book, which is also good. But yeah, isn't that interesting about the way the standard view of things can leave out a major important parts? And it seems like That's a lesson that you could draw from many episodes in recent history. You just can't believe people aren't seeing X and Y and Z. So today we're talking about a topic where there's been plenty of that, where, mm-hmm. for example, in American foreign policy, you get this is a bad guy, and that's the entirety of the analysis. But I agree right. that this is a bad guy. But the thing is, I have to factor in 12 other considerations to this if I'm going to make a good decision as to what to do about that bad guy. So we want to talk in particular, expand on a video you made, and I'll link to that video at tomwoods.com/1705, in which you interviewed two people I'm quite fond of. One, Thad Russell, who sometimes I find maddening, but maddening in ways that are really helpful for me, and Scott Horton, who's maddening only because I bet when you talk to him, you couldn't get him to stop talking. That is Scott Horton for you. But that
was my experience. Yeah. If I recall, that interview went on for about an hour, yeah. and I, ended up only being able to use a few minutes of it.
Right.
Fascinating, depth, font of knowledge.
Oh, he's absolutely unbelievable. So I was so glad in particular, because I know Thad has talked to Nick Gillespie before. I don't know how often Scott Horton has gotten exposure over on Reason TV. So to see him there was really nice to see. So we're talking about Trump and what people thought might happen with Trump in terms of foreign policy. And I include myself in this. I mean, I'm not infallible. And I didn't make any promises to anybody because you can never do that. I did bear in mind, I don't know if Scott told you Horton's Law, but Horton's Law is that politicians always keep their bad promises and forget about the good ones. And so he was warning me of this with Trump. You know, he'll do all the things he's threatening to do, but those things that make you a little bit hopeful, not so much. So let's try to refresh our memories about what were the kinds of things that Trump was saying in 2016 that made people who were concerned about war, you know, sort of stand up and take notice.
Yeah, he ran a campaign that appealed to many anti-war libertarians who said, you know, he's really bad on certain things, things like trade, but war is the most important issue. And on that, he's certainly much better than Hillary Clinton. And he actually represents a serious challenge to the foreign policy establishment that's been in control, arguably since the turn of the 20th century, but certainly since the turn of the 21st century. And this became, in 2016, a very common reason that I heard a lot of libertarian-leaning people expressing support for Trump, and in many cases, the number one reason. In the video, I feature a little excerpt from a Soho forum where Walter Block debated Nick Gillespie on this question and was making that exact case that, compared to Hillary at least, Trump would be a complete peacenik. And so as the 2020 election draws nearer, I just want to go back and examine some of those arguments and talk to some of the anti-war advocates like Scott Horton, who, as you mentioned, never was very optimistic about Trump, and then Thaddeus Russell, who was pretty optimistic and was saying at the beginning of his term that this represented a huge shift, just to see how they thought that had held up. And, you know, Thad and Scott both told me that Trump's lasting contribution will have been to, you know, change the conversation on the right around what the purpose of the U.S. military is. So that in its own is certainly something worth taking notice of. He memorably called out Jeb Bush on the debate stage for defending his brother's Iraq war, and he got booed for it. But we all know how that story turned out. He vanquished Jeb Bush, humiliated him, and kind of forced the Republican base to admit that Bush's foreign policy was a mistake. So that was a big deal, and a legitimate victory for the non-interventionist cause, I said, just moving things in that direction. He also gave speeches at the policy, the Institute for National Interest. He would say things like, you know, we can't force the Middle East to become a Western, a series of Western democracies through military force. I mean, this is just like right in line with what people like you've been saying, Ron Paul, Rand Paul have been saying. So he was saying a lot of the right things. He also, you know, expressed a general skepticism of international bodies like NATO. So rhetorically, Trump, you can see why he held a lot of appeal to anti-war libertarian types. And the reality, how it's played out, has been a little more complicated.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So we'll get into that. You know, there are people who say sometimes when we'll have a politician who's all talk and no action, and Trump says that about a lot of his opponents. You know, like sometimes people will say Tulsi Gabbard, if she got in power, probably wouldn't have done the things that she said she would do. So I'm not interested. And my view was I'm still interested, not to the point that I was supporting her, but I'm interested because talk is better than no talk and no action. At least talk gets other people talking. And unfortunately, a lot of our political conversations get their start from what some politician said. And so even if nothing comes of it, at least it gets people talking. And also you can't accuse Trump of being a wimp. You know, the way they used to try to accuse the Democrats of being wimps because they at least supposedly wanted a more dovish foreign policy. I'm not sure I really believe that. But you can't – like, this is another reason that I think Glenn Jacobs, otherwise known as Kane, the wrestler who's now mayor of Knox County in Tennessee, I think he would be fantastic on a presidential debate stage because, first of all, he's the size of you and me combined times two. There is no way you can convince people that he's a wimp when he says it's stupid, we should be home. So the fact that people like that, it's a Nixon to China sort of thing. So that is a is a good thing. But as you say, okay, well, you said some things. Now what comes of it? Let's talk about Afghanistan in particular, because here's a case of even Trump himself said, you know, normally I really like to follow my instincts. And my instincts were, let's get out of this war. And then, oh boy, it's hard to listen to the rest of what he had to say. It's almost like he's reading a ransom note.
Yeah, he reversed course and just said the thing that we hear a lot of politicians say. We've heard Obama say it once he gets elected, because Obama also ran as the relative peace candidate compared to John McCain, certainly. And even George W. Bush, when he was running, talked a big game about, you know, having a humble foreign policy, and even called out the idea of nation building. And then once Trump got in there, you know, he says in that speech that you're referencing that once the people around me started laying out the situation, I realized we couldn't just leave because it's going to be chaos. So we really need to meet these conditions. And then, but at the same time, you know, Trump is torn between these two different impulses. So he brokered this deal with the Taliban, and he is supposed to be taking troops out. Right now, there's about 8,500 troops there. They want to bring it down by the fall to about 4,600. And that has been met with severe resistance. And of course, we don't know if Trump's going to be reelected. So who knows how that's all going to play out. But the idea that this, you know, 20-year war, this is kind of like the low-hanging fruit in a way in terms of getting troops out. Like, we should be able to wind this down when you elect someone as disruptive of Trump, but it really shows you the kind of institutional obstacles that he's up against, that anyone who's going into that office is going to be up against. I mean, Liz Cheney partnered with Democrats in the House Armed Services Committee to use the power of the purse in Congress to say, no, you cannot withdraw troops from Afghanistan unless you meet these very vague conditions of, you know, stability, not letting these groups rise up again. Like, it's not any specific benchmarks. It's just the general, it has everything kind of has to be perfect before we can leave, or we're not going to give you the money that you need to withdraw troops, which is a total inversion of what Congress should be doing with its power, which is using the power of the purse to restrain, you know, unwarranted foreign adventures. So it's a deeply troubling situation. And if you want someone who's really going to do the job, it's got to be someone maybe like Kane or even Tulsi Gabbard. At least she, you know, puts foreign policy as, you know, when Tulsi Gabbard opens her mouth, she's going to talk about ending regime change war. She's going to talk about foreign policy. So just someone who prioritizes that first, I got to think that they're going to have a better chance at doing this than someone like Trump, who has a little bit of a short attention span.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That I think even though his message about Iraq resonated more with his base than people realize, because I think even in South Carolina, there were veterans sitting watching that TV who don't speak out much, but they heard him say that, and they knew he was right. They knew that that thing was a fiasco. You know, they may not be vocal about it, but they knew. So I think that resonated more than people think. But it's not his biggest issue with his base, and sometimes he has to drag them along on it. So why invest all the political capital he has on something that seems hopeless when he has other fish to fry? Whereas I think a Ron Paul would have just, because that to him is the top thing. Yes. He wouldn't have let go. He would have just kept on going and going and going and done whatever he needed to do to make it happen. But geez, as you say, you've got to be really committed to this. And the unfortunate thing is, maybe this speaks to another topic that you've covered that we might hit on for a few minutes. The problem with the anti-war movement, such as it is, it's extremely scattered. It tends to be partisan. It tends to disappear during, you know, the administrations of Democrats and stuff like that. There just isn't – yeah, I mean, the general public has a vague sense that this is a boondoggle, but they also know somebody. Almost everybody knows somebody in the military, and they feel like, well, they don't want to be viewed as being disrespectful toward them. So I think they kind of just grin and bear it.
Yeah, I produced a video shortly after the election of President Obama. and Thaddeus Russell was featured in that one too. It was just called What Happened to the Anti-War Movement, because a lot of us who were interested in the issue noticed that these massive protests that happened under the Bush administration during the run-up and kind of continuance of the Iraq War just disappeared, but the war-making didn't disappear. And I mean, part of that is just fatigue, and then part of it is just pure partisanship. I mean, there were surveys of the anti-war movement that showed the Democratic partisanship of the makeup of the movement just totally almost disappearing. It was pretty much weirdo independents and libertarians that were left behind, and some far left, you know, communist type people as well. So that was kind of the rump that was left behind after Obama took office and then kind of took warfare in a totally different direction with the emergence of drone campaigns. And that is an unfortunate aspect. Like these wars have been going on for so long now that even now that Trump is in power, there could be an anti-war movement. The left could be reinvigorated by that, but that's not really where their focus is anymore. It's kind of just like, this is just background noise now. Meanwhile, people are dying. We're continuing to create, you know, radical groups and fund radical groups in the Middle East that will eventually likely turn against us. So the whole dance is still going, but nobody's really listening to the music.
Well, and also, it seems to me that foreign policy just gets less and less significant as domestic problems pile up. I mean, really, with the COVID problem and the lockdowns and Black Lives Matter and unrest that could, you know, be ignited at any time in the cities, it seems much harder to persuade somebody that the fate of democracy in Uzbekistan is, you know, their primary concern.
Yeah. It's also become, I think that the technological aspect has really distanced people from it, because there are so much of our warfare now is drone-based or at least air-based. And, it, you know, in the case of Yemen and Somalia, these are where it's not even always direct U.S. involvement. It's like we are funding the Saudis to drop bombs and providing them with the bombs to drop, and, you know, the strategic, you know, giving them the strategic lay of the land, but not actually directly doing it, but still totally implicated in it. And certainly the people who are dying by the hundreds of thousands, their families certainly see it that way. So we have this psychological distance from it now. So that's a tough problem to overcome, to make people really care about it, when, you know, maybe their cousin or their brother isn't getting sent over there, but they're, you know, sitting in a portable in Nevada, you know, flying a drone and dropping the bombs that way.
Guys, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsor, the wonderful Policy Genius. This is a message you need to hear, by the way, and you know it. With everything going on right now, you may be wondering if it's even possible to buy life insurance right now. But the answer is yes, it's still easy to shop for life insurance right now. And if you have loved ones depending on your income, you probably should. Right now, you could save $1,500 or more a year by using Policy Genius to compare life insurance policies. When you're shopping for a policy that could last for a decade or more, those savings really start to add up. What is Policy Genius? It's an insurance marketplace built and backed by a team of industry experts. And here's how it works. Very simple. Step one, head to policygenius.com. In minutes, you can work out how much coverage you need, compare quotes from top insurers, find your best price. Step two, apply for your lowest price. Step three, the Policy Genius team will handle all the paperwork and red tape. Policy Genius works for you, not the insurance company. So if you hit any speed bumps during the application process, they'll take care of everything. They even have policies that allow eligible customers to skip the in-person medical exam and just do it over the phone. So if you need life insurance, head to policygenius.com right now to get started. You could save $1,500 or more a year by comparing quotes on their marketplace. Policy Genius. When it comes to insurance, it's nice to get it right. One of the things people say in defense of Trump is that he hasn't started any new wars. And it's mm-hmm. pretty sad when you're reduced to that. that's the best we can come up with. But you know, compared to others, that is at least something. But what's the other side of that ledger?
Well, he hasn't started any new wars, and that I will give him credit for that. I am not sure that he has made the world overall more peaceful, because there have been certain regions where tensions have really been ramped up. I mean, we know that he tore up the Iran nuclear deal, right? So Iran, and what did Iran do after that deal was torn up? They started enriching more uranium. They started becoming less transparent. Trump pulled out of the Russian Open Skies Treaty, and Russia has also decreased its transparency. He's ramped up tensions with China via the trade war, and we've also put more nuclear weapons out into the Pacific Ocean somewhere. And, you know, nobody likes to think about the nuclear question. It's a very uncomfortable thing to ponder, and you almost start to seem a little bit like paranoid or frantic when you think about when you like seriously start to talk about what could happen with nuclear weapons. But I think Trump in general, with dealing with these nuclear powers, has probably pushed us more in a worse direction. And that does make me nervous. We also know that from the beginning, he had Iran hawks around him. Michael Flynn, for all of the, you know, he had some good ideas in terms of rethinking the Middle East strategy, but he's always been an Iran hawk, and Trump has always seemed to be on board with that. So tensions with Iran are not a good thing, and I don't know how that's going to play out. And even, you know, with Russia, despite the way Trump has been portrayed, his relationship with Russia has been portrayed, you know, it's not exactly like tensions have been totally eased there. And depending on what happens after the election, that's another potentially volatile situation.
You know, this whole thing reminds me of one of the most, I don't know, elusive things about Trump, but mystifying, stupefying, is his personnel choices. I remember seeing his base cheering when he got rid of John Bolton. But it's not like John Bolton is a built-in feature of the White House. You know, he brought on John Bolton. Or he was against Elliot Abrams because Abrams had opposed Trump in the primaries or something, in the election. But that's not the reason to be against Elliot Abrams, because he's part of the foreign policy establishment. And you're here, you're supposed to be here to be a bull in a china shop there. And you're surrounding yourself by Mike Pompeo and all these other people. And then you wonder why it seems like there are leaks everywhere. You're being undermined at every turn. He, again, part of his lack of curiosity and his impatience involves not even knowing where to go if he wanted to surround himself with people who want to implement what he says he wants. He doesn't even know who those people would be.
Yeah, it's a big problem. And I think it's part of the problem is, I mean, first of all, we know that the John Bolton choice is sort of a mystery. We have some ideas of why he did that. One possibility is, you know, he liked watching him on Fox News and was familiar with him. Another possibility is he thought just kind of having John Bolton would make his foreign adversaries a little bit more nervous, and he was a bargaining chip, and or he was, you know, this, he was going to have John Bolton on a leash, but he could always unleash him if he needed to. So it was kind of just like making his administration look a little more tough.
I had actually never heard that theory. It makes so much sense.
Yeah, I mean, that's one theory. It's hard, you know, getting into the psychology of Trump only leads to madness.
Yeah,
I think,
right. But yeah, that's as plausible, you know, as anything I've heard.
Yeah, but then with the personnel issue, also, it's just that these ideas have been so marginalized in D.C. for so long that there's not a strong...
Where would you even go?
Yeah. And that I think is the way forward that we need to focus on. Like, Trump has opened up this conversation, and now we need to build on that. There is the new Quincy Institute, which is trying to do that in D.C., trying to make a serious, you know, think tank that walks through the logic of non-interventionism and how can we actually start methodically extracting ourselves from these wars in a way that's like politically sustainable. Because, you know, when we start pulling out of Afghanistan, if we ever actually do that, there will be chaotic actions. We just saw today that in Afghanistan, a prison was raided by ISIS, apparently, and they like freed 2,000 people out of there. So like this stuff is going to happen and people are going to say, oh, this is a huge mistake. So we've got to figure out a way to do this. And that does start with personnel who've thought this through. And I'm hoping that that's one thing that will come out of all this, is that that kind of base will start to be built up, so that if we ever get another person with these non-interventionist instincts back into office, that they'll have more of a pool to draw from.
Well, as we wrap up today, I want to close with a personal question, if I may. We've been saying that, you know, holding a view outside the parameters established by the bipartisan foreign policy consensus is unpopular and unusual and so on. So how did you yourself come to hold these opinions? Because I used to be a neocon because in my day there was no internet and I thought there were two choices, and so I picked one. But I eventually learned the error of my ways. Were you the same way, or were you right from the beginning, so to speak?
No, I was kind of apolitical, but I was in college during the Iraq War, and I had a good friend who was in the Marines, and I would write to him as he was going through basic training. And just having that relationship and really thinking about, wow, why? Already by then, I could see that this was not really about making America safer. And I was just like, why is my friend going to Iraq right now? This makes no sense to me. This is not making us safer from terrorist attacks. That story never like quickly started to not make sense to me. And basically the Bush-Kerry election happened, and I looked at these two guys, and you know, Bush obviously was not the right choice, but even I started listening to what John Kerry was saying, and he wasn't really saying that he was going to end the war in Iraq in any, you know, expeditious manner. And so I started kind of poking around, and I found the Libertarian Party, and I saw that they actually were in favor of ending the Iraq War, and I started digging more into what libertarianism was all about. And I thought, oh, this is an interesting philosophy that aligns with a lot of what I already kind of have a general sense for. So I started building my beliefs there. And then, you know, the Ron Paul campaign happened in 2008, and he was the one person on stage that was making any sense about this. And so that really kind of solidified my views and feelings about the foreign policy issue. So I've definitely on the same page as people like Thaddeus and Scott Horton, who say that foreign policy really should be the number one thing when you're looking at a presidential candidate, especially because that's what where they have the most power. I just hope that going forward, we're able to find someone who really prioritizes that instead of kind of talks a big game and then doesn't have the kind of depth of knowledge, strategic thinking, and just passion to make it happen.
I really do think, just my impression is, that the general public is bored with the issue at this point. It's not like you're seeing images of children being napalmed, you know, like you used to in the Vietnam War and stuff like that, you know, Agent Orange or whatever. You're not seeing any of that. And it's out of there, you know, out of sight, out of mind. So I think the only way to really run on it right now would be to point out how anomalous it is that, you know, right now we've got all these problems in the country and, you know, whatever. You could even say we don't have enough masks or this or that. We don't have enough supplies for this and that. But for some reason, we have all the resources in the world to send all these people this far away to do heaven knows what, to try to connect it to domestic problems, because that's the only thing that gets people's attention. And if that's what works, then do it. And it would be nice to hear Trump talk that way. But I fear that foreign policy in this, I mean, look, we've only got a few more months till the election. I think it's just going to be invisible.
That's also something that Scott Horton was bringing up to me when I was probing him a little bit of like, how would this become a salient issue? And he said, you know, either it would be some sort of like horrific disaster, which we hope doesn't happen overseas to our troops, that really focuses attention, or there is kind of the reality of we're running out of money. And with all the spending that's been happening through the lockdown, you know, that might be the reality that's upon us sooner, is we're just not going to be able to afford that. And I think that's a case that more and more Americans might start to get soon.
Well, Zach, I appreciate your time. I'm going to link people to the video that we've been jumping off from at tomwoods.com/1705. I'll also link to the video you did with Thad on the anti-war movement. Why not? Let's put that up there as well so people can get more of a taste of what you've been up to. And thanks again.
Thank you, Tom.
All right, everybody, tomwoods.com/1705 is where to go to watch those videos. That's it for today. Tomorrow, it'll be me all by myself, and then resuming with guests the following day. Now, next week, I've got something lined up for you that I think will be fun. We got two people who are not, let's say, shy about talking on podcasts. Let's put it that way. Our friends Gene Epstein and David Stockman will be on the same episode together because they have radically different views of the condition of the economy and what's likely to happen in the near future. And I thought it'd be nice to have them hash that out. And that'll probably take, knowing those two gentlemen, all of the programming time we have for next week. So anyway, if there's only one episode next week, you'll know why. Anyway, subscribe over at tomwoods.com/apple. We'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.